This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people, some at the top of their game, others still climbing, all possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their visions. I'm not a journalist. I'm a deep thinker, a conversationalist. I won't be engaging my guests as a passive, neutral moderator. I have a perspective, an opinion on just about everything. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives. In this space, I hope to deepen, broaden, and sometimes even shift my own opinion by opening myself up to the thoughtful insights of others. I invite you to join me on this journey.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
In honor of Mental Illness Awareness Week, I'm grateful to have scholar, activist, and sister friend Monica A. Coleman on the AYG List. Monica's commitment to connecting faith and social justice is evident in all of her endeavors. An ordained elder in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, she earned her AB in African American Studies at Harvard University, her Master's of Divinity degree, and certificate in the study of religion, gender, and sexuality at Vanderbilt University, and her MA and PhD in philosophy of religion and theology at Claremont Graduate University, where she is currently Associate Professor of Constructive Theology and African American Religions, and co-director of the Center for Process Studies. Monica, who lives with depression, is a mental health advocate who is dedicated to educating the public about the lives and rights of people living with mental illness. In her most recent book, Not Alone, Reflections on Faith and Depression, she offers a 40-day devotional, Wrestling with Depression in a Spiritual Context. I speak with her about our current cultural understandings and misperceptions about mental illness, how the faith community can and should respond to mental illness, and resources and solutions for those dealing with mental health concerns. Welcome to the AYG List, Monica.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you and I have been dear friends for years. Your mother's twin sister, your aunt, is one of my church aunties, and you served on the board of my nonprofit Civic Frame for years. Thank you so much. And I actually caught the bouquet at your wedding, though I'm still not married. I'll let God take care of that. And now you are a mother. Additionally, you are a highly regarded scholar in your field and a sought-after activist regarding issues of sexual violence and mental health. We talk all the time. However, it wasn't until this past Lent when you invited me to be a part of your special reading group for your new book, Not Alone, Reflections on Faith and Depression, that I became really present not only to your own personal struggle with mental illness, but the challenges faced by others, including my loved ones. So what I wanted to do is to start our time together by asking you if you would share when you first discovered your mental illness and how you charted a path to living powerfully. And I'm using those words because you're my friend and someone I know, but I know that many people who know you and many people who enjoy you as a colleague in your field of endeavors also see you this way. So if you could talk to us a little bit about how you charted your path to living powerfully with mental illness, I think that would be a great starting point.
I'll try to give the short version. In hindsight, 2020, right? So I can look back into my teenage years and see where I was really had a lot of severe depression and even suicidal ideation. But at the time, it's very difficult, I think, with all teenagers, and definitely this is all pre-Columbine. There weren't counselors in high school, right, like there are now, whose eyes are alert looking for young people who may have challenges. At the time, it just seemed like I was sad or I was moody, and all teenagers are moody, right? So
yeah.
It's very difficult, I think, with adolescents in particular, to know what's just being a teenager and hormones and, you know, the drama of high school life.
Yeah.
Versus something really probably really wrong, or something is more extreme than it should be. Mm-hmm. So now I can kind of look back and see where my grief was really more depression. You know, grief over losing my grandmother was much more like depression than grief. I can see that now. But I think I didn't come to my own realization about it probably until college. And then still not really until my doctoral program, so two graduate degrees later, did I really get to take seriously. This is something I live with and I can't ignore it. I can't pretend it's not there. I can't act like, oh, I'm a little depressed, like I might use in common parlance. But this is part of the texture of my life. And this was after a really serious bout of depression with suicidal ideation, you know, really losing a grip on the functionality in my life. I had to say, wow, I need to stop everything, kind of take care of this, make some life changes so I could get support that I needed, so I could get health care that I needed, so I could be near places that were loving and supportive and good doctors. And then now it's woven into the texture of my life. So I know what to pay attention to, what not to, when I need therapy, when I don't.
That sounds like, though, that there was this critical juncture where you yourself discovered that, okay, this isn't normal, but, you know, there are a lot of people who kind of get to that point, but then they don't really connect with the resources that they need to kind of make the leap to getting the help. So what was the difference for you and not just kind of saying, okay, I have no idea how to deal with this, and going to the direction of, I need help and this is the place where I can go to get it?
Well, I had intellectual knowledge about what to do, right? I had worked as a community organizer. I'm a minister. I know how to get people help. I know how to navigate social services. But when it's you who's sick, it doesn't really matter what you intellectually know, because you can't be your own best advocate. You're too busy being sick. Really, it was the intervention of friends, of people I worked with saying, you know, I think you should talk to so-and-so. Here's a number. Let me take you there. People really noticing and paying attention and making me aware that this was not something small, but this was something bigger that I really needed to pay attention to. So for me, that's really what it was. It was really the intervening eyes and help from people who were around me at that time.
Okay. And we're going to get into that a little bit more, because I think all of us need to know how to care for our friends and loved ones and ourselves if we're going through mental illness crises in our lives. And I'm grateful that you're going to be a well of resources for that. But one of the things that was really critical was you penned this really powerful piece in the Huffington Post entitled Losing Faith, Finding Hope, A Journey with Depression, where you chronicled your struggle with faith while battling depression. And I think that was such a major piece for so many people, because one of the things that we don't really talk about is, how does the faith community deal with mental illness? And you have also dedicated a great deal of your life at this point as an activist with regard to that. Tell me how that whole thing came about. You are an ordained minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Tell me how that kind of came about for you and how it was received.
To my knowledge, the article was received pretty well, and I got a lot of feedback from other people saying, yes, I've experienced the same thing. For me, it was having to push yourself to be honest, to say the things I inherited in church didn't work for me. Right? And that's really hard for most people to do. I'm a trained theologian, so I know it's okay. I know there are many ways to be faithful, many ways just to be Christian. I have that kind of knowledge base. And most people's experience with Christianity is one or two churches, right? One or two or three ministers speaking. And so you don't know that there's a different option besides what's in front of you. So what happens with most people is, if what you're hearing doesn't work for you, you either reject the whole religion, or you try and convince yourself that what you're experiencing is not what you're experiencing. For me, I'm like, no, this is what I'm experiencing, but the things I've been taught about, or that I'm hearing preached or read about, or almost by default, that I'm too blessed to be stressed. Well, no, I really am blessed, but I'm also stressed and depressed, and you can actually be both,
right?
These aren't necessarily opposites. Hearing people talk about depression like it's demonic possession, and we're now several centuries old as compared to modern medicine. Those kinds of things really didn't work for me and made me feel like, wow, this church or this place where I am, which I know is a place that's been helpful in so many other aspects of advocacy and civil rights and justice, doesn't see me, doesn't acknowledge me, doesn't think that what I'm experiencing is the same thing as a person who they're praying for who has diabetes or who had heart surgery.
So
I had to come up with another way of thinking about my faith. And for me, it was already in kind of my arsenal of things I was thinking about. But to really be able to embrace what matters more than anything else is God's presence. And knowing that God is with me, not judging me, not punishing me, not teaching me, not doing anything necessarily, except being present and understanding me and feeling with me. That's big.
Yeah, it is. Very, very powerful. You have charted your life personally and professionally in a pretty extraordinary way. I think when people think of people who are dealing with mental illness, they think of folks who are pretty incapacitated. They don't think of people who are highly functioning. They don't think of people who are really successful. And I see you as one of my friends who really kind of manages it. And also you give this wonderful, you know, witness to the world. But you had to make some decisions about who you were going to be personally and professionally. I'm very curious about how you now and how you did in the past navigate these issues that come up due to your mental health challenges with regard to those two aspects of your life, personally and professionally.
It's hard. It is hard.
Right.
For me, I had to learn myself and learn my own condition. Everyone's condition is differently, and it expresses itself differently in each person. And I am what they call highly functional, right? And that's just how my condition is. There are downsides to that. The downsides are I can commit to things when I feel well that I cannot follow through on when I don't feel well. Mm-hmm. It means sometimes that doctors don't believe me when I tell them I'm not feeling well. They say, oh, but you have a 4.0. Oh, but you're doing this. I'm like, yeah, but trust me, I'm sad. Listen to me.
Right.
So sometimes I've had kind of bad doctors, doctors who didn't watch me the way they needed to, and I got sick because they did not believe I wasn't well. But it also means that I have to kind of make decisions about what I'm going to do, where I'm going to live. Like, I can't live in places where it's gray and rainy. Right? That's not going to work
for me.
Right,
Seattle is not working for you.
Right. I didn't even look for jobs there. Right? I can't imagine. Or when I did decide to take a job in a colder climate again, I had to be really, really careful and cognizant in travel about getting to sun, for example. Yeah. And budget for that. The kind of partnerships I make a difference. It just means, for me, everyone else might see me as being productive, but I'm always aware of what I'm not doing. I'm aware of what I'm saying no to, of the things I like to do but can't do. It also means I build stuff into my life that can't be optional. So exercise is not optional for me. It's part of being healthy, like being okay in the world. Like, I have to work out. I have to get my endorphins. I have to be fit. Now, there are lots of great benefits to that, but that also means I'm carving out time to do that, but I'm not doing something else, right?
Right.
Because we all have limited amounts of time. I have to be really careful about other aspects of my life that can contribute to depression, how I eat. Like, you know, I like sugar. Who doesn't like sugar? I have a sweet tooth. You know, sugar's not so great for depression, as an example. So paying attention to my diet, how much, you know, vitamin C I'm getting, how many omega-3s. And I'm a pretty crunchy, healthy person anyway, but I have to kind of pay particular attention to that and making sure I kind of get these things in my diet. Then also knowing when I need therapy and having to work that out with health insurance and co-payments and that kind of thing. To make sure that there is someone paying attention to me and that I have a place to kind of deal with stress so stress doesn't become depression. But once I kind of can put those things in place and I'm more accustomed to it now, it doesn't feel as hard as it sounds.
Right,
and the other
right.
part was just having to be honest. And when I can't do something and I'm trying to do it, to say, you know, I thought I could do this, I promised I could do this, but I'm sick and I can't do this. And just having that kind of difficult integrity to tell someone I can't do what I committed to do, let me give you a referral. Let me tell you someone else who might be able to step in for me. And doing that and not thinking I have to do everything, because if I'm not around, I can't do anything.
That's right. So on some levels, because you're highly functioning, I mean, people see the credentials, they see the great work you do, they see your smiling face all the time, and they see the energy that you project, and it is very authentic. But there are serious ways in which mental illness has shaped your life and your convictions and your commitments. And I don't think that's a conversation that the two of us have ever really had, but I think that I'm aware of it because I know you. Can you talk a little bit about, in ways that may be apparent to you and in ways that may be a little bit more subtle to you, how your mental illness has shaped your convictions and your commitments in your life?
I think in terms of my convictions, because I know how lonely and isolating it can be to feel, at least for myself, depression. You feel like you're the only one who knows what you're feeling in the way you are, right? Only one who's inside your head. You're only one who's there at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. For me, especially as a theologian and minister, nothing is more important than God's omnipresence. Nothing is more important than saying and knowing and somehow getting to the fact that God is here. God is with us. Right, this radical sense of incarnation. And when you push that, you get some different things theologically. But, you know, even just the conviction that God's not judging, God is just here feeling, like God actually does know me from the inside out. And for me, that cuts away loneliness, right? And that becomes a major conviction that drives a lot of the work I do academically in churches, to say that if we say nothing else, we can say that God isn't doing all the different things that we say God is doing when we're suffering, right?
Teaching
us stuff, working it out for our good, all these different... No, God is just here. God has not left you. God has not abandoned you. But God is here, and God is dealing with you. And in the midst of that, God still wants the best for you. You know, so for me, those are personal and theological and religious commitments that I think are very much influenced by my experiences both as a survivor of sexual violence and as someone who lives ongoing with a mental health challenge.
Powerful. Let's pivot a little bit. You know, we've seen so much in the media about gun and other forms of violence being attributed to mental illness. And there are incredible presumptions that people with mental illness are dangerous, violent, or will go crazy with very little provocation. What are we getting wrong here?
Well, I think the first thing is that most people who live with mental health challenges are probably a greater danger to themselves than they are to anyone else. You know, suicidal ideation is real for so many people. You know, just the thinking about it, it comes from this desperation of how painful and difficult it really can be to live with a mental health challenge. And that doesn't include things like psychosis, which is much more complex and involved, you know, schizophrenia, where, you know, one really does hear different voices in your head, you know, that you are interacting with and almost arguing with and trying to figure out what the right thing to do is, right? So some of it is, the first part is that one's more likely to do more violence themselves than they are to other people. And I think the other part that we don't always pay attention to is how much so many of us are desensitized to violence, right? To how much violence we're exposed to, whether it's video games or TV or even the radio, how normal this is a part of our lives. So when someone then embraces this in the quote-unquote real world, because it's all real world, right, when they actually engages in this, we seem shocked, right? But without really being able to notice, like, wait, this really is kind of part of the sea we're all swimming in.
Well, you know, I think there's a point where most people really don't have a base level understanding of mental illness and how to care for people in their lives who they think may be dealing with it or who they know may be dealing with it. What can you offer to folks who are in the midst of folks who might be having mental health challenges? There seems to be a real lack of empathy, but also an inability to figure out how to be of aid to someone with regard to mental illness. What would be kind of the first initial steps that you would recommend?
And if I were really worried about somebody who's close to me or somebody who I knew, one of the first things I would do is I would try to find somebody I thought knew more, right? Whether that would be a minister or a therapist. I would call a helpline, right? I mean, helplines aren't just for the individual who needs help, but someone who's trying to help that person.
Right?
I remember when we were growing up, they used to have all those billboards about, right, about those 24-hour helplines you could call. I don't know why they're not up anymore. I mean, there's still billboards up, but I don't see those kind of things. Those used to be in our teen magazines, right?
Well, we've cut a lot of money out of, we've cut a lot of money from, you know, mental health care in this country. So I think that's part of it.
Right, but, you know, but, you know, you could still Google a line, you know, you really can and say, you can even Google the question, who, you know, I saw a page recently, like, when someone on Facebook says something suicidal, what do I do? Right? I mean, you can actually Google that. You can Google your question if you want.
And it
will give you a number. You can put a zip code in. And I would talk to somebody who knows more and tell them what you're seeing, and they could probably give you probably the best advice of what you should do. Now, if it's for emergent, you know, call 911. You know, just like all doctor's offices say, if somebody's got a knife, don't call the helpline. You call 911.
What do you think, being on the other side of this? I mean, because just because you're living with mental illness doesn't mean that you aren't in the presence of other folks who are experiencing this, and so you come to aid. What do you think, for just general people, are the biggest kinds of fears about confronting it?
That's a good question. I think people are, as it sounds like, afraid that people will think they're crazy, right?
Literally.
And people are afraid of being, people are afraid of being judged, right? I mean, we use the word crazy a lot. Even I use it somewhat lackadaisically, right? Not to refer, you know, but it definitely is something pejorative. No one uses it to say, oh, that's wonderful, right? People are, I think, really afraid of being judged. So, well, what does this mean for me? What do people think about me? And some of that is fair. The stigma is still really real. It's less than it used to be, But sure, there is still a significant stigma, especially depending on where you live and the kind of surroundings and community you're in. You know, I mean, I live in California. Everyone has a therapist, right? Oh, I'm going to see a therapist.
Right.
So, but this is unusual. This is not typical, I think, for the U.S., let alone if you're in an immigrant culture or cultures of people of color where there's just much less trust of the Western medical system, and for good historical reason. I think people feel, I'm worried about being judged. And then say, I'm worried about what this would mean. Like, all the different rumors we've heard out there, you begin to ask, oh, my God, will I take medication? Can I afford the medication? Will I take it for the rest of my life? What does this mean? Mm-hmm. See those little commercials, right, on TV where a person takes a pill and 10 seconds later they're living in sunshine and sipping through the fields, right? It's not like that.
Right.
I mean, I hate those commercials, right?
Right.
But you wonder, well, what will this really mean? And so I think it's this fear of unknown and fear of being judged. And I wish I could say that one didn't have to fear that, but I can't.
Right. Well, but you also, as a person who is living, I believe, very empowered in this space, know that there are scenarios that we can create that give a great deal of comfort. For those who are caring for people who are facing mental illness challenges, what is the comfort? Is the comfort in being able to tell, being able to have the space for truth to be told, and then the space to kind of, you know, work through it at your own pace? Like, what is the space that needs to be created by those of us who are caring?
For me, the thing that I find personally, and even with other people, to be the most fantasy-making, so to say, is knowing other people who live with mental health challenges and having those friends I can talk to, and we understand each other. Even though clearly our conditions are as individual as we are, there will be enough similarities, or we'll know just from the sound of another person's voice, hi, what's wrong? You know? That kind of a friendship, and this person who's not going to judge me, not going to give me advice, not going to tell me what to do, right? Because you know what to do. To say, I hear you. I'm worried about you. Let's talk together. Let me listen for you. If you're in the same city, let me just come by and hang out with you and watch TV with you. So if you're not going to move, let me not move there with you so you're not by yourself. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's that kind of thing. Now, that's, mind you, while someone also does have professional help to go to. So it's this is not in lieu of more formal mental health services. But I think as someone who, if you love someone who has a mental health challenge, to me, that's what I find comforting, is either connect that person with somebody else, right? Or to me, this is divine activity, right? To be present without judgment, to just be there, to
that's
care.
That's hard, Monica. You know, it makes
stuff easier.
Yeah, I think it's a little hard for some folks. I mean, I think of things that I've experienced with loved ones where, you know, generationally and spiritually, as you know, it can be a wall because people just think folks are acting out and they should just get it together, right? So, you know, I've had a loved one who kind of experienced a psychotic breakdown, and it was tough because I think there are people who interact with folks and they've seen this behavior time and time again, and they see it as bad behavior and not a mental illness because there's not a cultural or human understanding of mental illness. So I'm trying to figure out how we bridge that, and I'm sure it's a very, very delicate bridge, but I think there's a lot of education, like you said, that needs to be done within cultural communities, within all communities with regard to how to deal with that. What would you say a little bit about how to kind of approach folks, especially family members, who really have a challenge understanding the confines of and the strictures of mental illness?
Well, family is particularly difficult, right, because our family relationships are so complex. Right? There's so much history there. You don't get to choose these people in your life. They're just there.
Right.
And their impact on you is greater. I mean, this is one reason why I'm an advocate for mental health services, for therapy, because I really believe, this is just my own personal conviction, that someone has to get paid, whether you're paying them or your insurance is paying them or the government, however it's being worked out. You need someone has to be paid to actually care about you for in and of yourself, right? Because when we have relationships, we care about them, but we're also aware of how it impacts us, right, as individuals. And you can't divorce that. You can't not bring that to the situation, right, because it's human to do that. We're relational people, relational beings. We're going to think about someone else's well-being, but we're also going to think about, well, how does this impact me? Well, because it's negatively impacting me, it's really hard for me to care just about how you're doing.
Yeah.
And that's what therapists do, right?
Their
job is to really just care about what's best for this individual, regardless of how it, you know, it's not going to have a personal impact on that therapist. So they can hear in a different way and assist in a different way. I think one big part is getting someone towards that kind of help they need. And that may mean sometimes leveraging individuals who are trusted. And for me, this is why faith communities make such a big difference when it comes to dealing with mental health challenges. For people who might not trust Western medicine or have the best relationship or be able to get to Western medical services, people can get to faith communities. And often will, you know, I know as a minister, people bring me things that are well above my pay grade. I have no idea how to deal with things I didn't even think happened in real life, I've heard, as a minister. And to go to a minister, and then it's on ministers to have those relationships in their neighborhoods, in their communities, where they can say, not only perhaps you have a deeper challenge, I can pray for you and I can talk about your spirituality, but I have a friend who you can talk to. And that's just give a number, because that doesn't work. You have to say, hey, let's drive over there. You know, let me introduce you to this person. Let me call them and have them come over here so you can meet them. I mean, having that really personal connection makes a huge difference in terms of trust. And you have to trust somebody. And so to me, that's why it's so important that faith leaders and faith communities take an active role in not just praying about mental health, but talking about it, preaching about it, and making those kind of connections.
I'm going to trouble this a little bit more because it just occurred to me as I was listening to you and as I was thinking about things that we've both experienced with loved ones, that the other side of this are people who care for folks with mental illness who are ill-equipped, and they also need help in trying to figure that out. And I know that NAMI and some other organizations have great resources for that. What would you say to the caretakers, the people who love folks who are facing mental illness challenges?
Well, you mentioned NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, and they are, to me, one of the best resources out there.
Yeah.
They have really great things in terms of faith communities, in terms of different communities of color, and really being helpful to those who are caretakers and family members. And they have training, and most of this stuff is free. You can find a lot of stuff online at NAMI.org. But, you know, even if you can't quite get to that, you know, there are a lot of groups for caregivers, you know, for all kinds of caregivers. You can find a meetup for caregivers. You could probably even call your local hospital or even ask your doctor or your the person you're caring for, a doctor, like, do you know of groups where I can talk to other people who are caring for loved ones? For me, it's just so much power in community, so much power in knowing you're not alone. And there's a lot of good problem solving. You know, most of what you're experiencing, someone else would probably also experience. You could say, what did you do when? Well, I did this, or I thought about this, or did you know about this resource in our community that can make it so you're not trying to reinvent the wheel?
Yeah, you are not alone. Yeah.
Right.
On October 10th, there is a National Depression Screening Day, and this day is set aside annually to screen people for depression and related mood and anxiety disorders, and they've been doing this since 1991. They've really targeted military personnel, college students, workplace environments, and the general public. Why is screening so important, Monica?
I remember I was at a church where we participated in that screening day, which was really great, led by a psychiatrist who was a member of the church. One thing it matters is because they ask you the questions that a regular person might not think to ask you.
Right.
And they ask you they ask them all together. One of your friends might know you're not sleeping well. Another friend might know you're stressed about something else. But you might not have talked to any one person to say, oh, wow, look, I'm knocking off 9 or 10 of these things. Like, wow, you know, something might really, maybe something I should pay attention to or something I should get help with. Because if it's a questionnaire, right? This is kind of what doctors do. They ask you these questions, and it allows you, it's also very empowering, I think, the screening, because it's not just like getting your eyes screened, right, or someone taking your blood, but you're able to kind of think for a moment, oh, do I experience this? Do I experience that? Wow, maybe something is wrong, or it could be it's only been a couple of days and there's a concrete issue for why that is, and it's not a clinical depression, right?
Right.
So it really could be the opposite, like, oh my God, I haven't slept in 3 days, but it could be related to something very concrete and not be a big issue. It's also very helpful just to have someone else who's somewhat trained to sit there and ask you some of these questions and to begin to reflect. For so many of us, because our lives are hectic or because our lives are desperate, we feel like we don't have the time to reflect on how I'm doing, like really how I'm doing, not the how I'm doing, I'm fine.
Right.
And this is that kind of opportunity.
All right, we're going to pivot back. If you weren't a scholar / activist, who would you be?
So if I didn't do what I did now?
Yeah. And you do a lot, so I know I'm asking you a lot.
Right. Well, I guess, like, what would I like to do? Like, my other kind of things I'd be interested in doing. Well, this might still be activist. I really do have interest in community health and grassroots health, public health. That might be something I would be interested in doing, and especially around women's health. It's just really passion, kind of a passion for me, and a lot of alternative health stuff. That, or maybe I'd be, like, a vegan chef. So maybe I'd be, I don't want to have a restaurant, though, because that's such a risky business. Maybe I'd be like a vegan caterer or something. You know, people who don't want to cook but want the food, they could pay me a certain amount per week and I'll drop some food off at their house.
You could make sweet potato pies that were at your wedding. I think you'd be really successful.
I didn't make pie, though.
I know you didn't, but if you can, you could recreate that beauty, I mean, we'd be in business. Okay, the final question is, you know that today is the National Day of Prayer for Mental Health Recovery and Understanding, and you are a wonderful ordained minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. What would be your prayer for those who are listening?
You know, I've been thinking about that, and, you know, I think for me, as someone who lives with a mental health challenge, I want a prayer with feet. Right? I think about Abraham Heschel talking about how marching with King was praying with his feet. I want a prayer with feet. It doesn't really help me personally if you say, oh, dear God, let's become more aware. Oh, dear God, let's be more sensitive. And there's a room for that because I believe that God can move and change our hearts. But I want a prayer that says, what can I do for people in my community? What can I preach? Right, this is what I'd like to see clergy doing, asking about what they could preach about next week that would matter, right, that would highlight and bring to awareness and non-judgment, mental health challenges. I want to say, you know, where can I volunteer? Who can I sit with? Who do I need to check in on? Who seems to have fallen off the face of the earth? Or, you know, even something like, I did a funeral 3 months ago. I know grief doesn't go away really quickly. Let me just call that person and see how they're doing, right?
Yeah.
To me, those are the kind of prayers I would like to see.
Actually, tell us how we can find you on the internet, on the web, and all the other things that you're doing.
Right. Well, easiest place to find me on my website, MonicaAColeman.com. And you can find me on Twitter there, Facebook, Pinterest. And I do the reading group every Lent. So if you're interested in reading through the book Not Alone with me and some other people, it's an online reading group. And so you go to my website and sign up for a newsletter, then you'll get information about that. Or just keep checking back and you'll see more information.
Reverend Dr. Monica A. Coleman, a scholar, an activist, a theologian who prays with feet. Thank you so much for joining us on this important week of sharing your personal experience with mental illness in a really informative and empowering way, and just being who you are to all of us in the world who know you. And for my audience who will get to know you, I am so delighted to be able to share all the light that you bring to the world. Thank you so much for being here on the AYG list and for being my dear, dear friend.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It's good to be here.
You've been listening to the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG List posts every Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG List. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening.